I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Walt Disney World in Central Florida has 4 theme parks, dozens of resorts, and even more restaurants on its sprawling property, enough to overwhelm first-time visitors. Authors and bloggers Dave Shute and Josh Humphrey want to ease the confusion with their new book, The Easy Guide to Your First Walt Disney World Visit 2014. I'll speak with them about how to navigate Walt Disney World and what the resort is doing to stay competitive. Also, travel experts are expecting this summer to be the best year for travel since the recession.
We've had what, 4 or 5 years of basically no one taking a vacation, so this is the first summer that people are actually thinking about going somewhere.
I'll revisit a conversation with National Geographic Editor-at-Large and consumer advocate Chris Elliott about the impact a booming travel season will have on Central Florida. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Josh Humphrey, and joining me by phone is Dave Shute. Dave and Josh are the authors of The Easy Guide to Your First Walt Disney World Visit. Josh, thanks for coming in.
Of course, thanks for having me.
And Dave, thanks for joining us by phone.
Hey, it's great to be here.
The book is called An Easy Guide. It's nearly 264 pages of information. It's encyclopedic. I've just been kind of leafing through it this afternoon, and there's a couple of cool things I like. You've got some graphs in there sort of charting the hottest times of the year to visit Disney, and also some nice little bar graphs showing the when it's going to be most crowded at Disney. And these are two of the things that I think anybody visiting Disney World or any of the theme parks here in Central Florida, for that matter, has to be aware of. What kind of made you decide to break it down and add these kind of extra things like these graphs and try and sort of make it easy for people?
Well, I think, you know, people understand and learn in different ways. You know, some understand from text, some understand from charts. And in general, the graphs are in there to reinforce points that Josh and I have made elsewhere, but, you know, lay them out quickly and easily and visually. So if someone's picking a week, they can read through our material on month by month, what's a good time and what's a bad time, or they can just go to that chart or to one of those tables and just scan it down and see here's a high crowd, high price time, and here's a low crowd, low price time.
Josh, I want to ask you a question. There's so much information in the book. How did you go about kind of collecting and curating it all?
Well, I've lived here for about 3 years and go to the theme parks 3, 5, 7 days a week. And it's been several years of just walking around the theme parks, taking in the attractions, what people are doing, what they're eating. You can tell just based on what people look like throughout the year, how good of a time they're having. And we've tried to bring that all into the book so it's easy for the reader to understand why a certain time is better than another time.
And when you say based on what people look like, you're talking about just kind of whether they look hot and overwhelmed. I know a lot of people bring a lot of small kids to Disney World, and as you point out in the book, you can walk a long way at Disney World either pushing a buggy or just walking on your own 2 feet and get a pretty good workout in there. And if it's blazing hot and you've got a bunch of kids with you, that can sometimes be not altogether fun.
Yeah, one of the things I do on the site is I'll take a picture of the theme parks and it'll say, count the smiles. And from June, July, August, people are having a good time, but it's so hot and they're so stressed out from the heat and the number of people that they're not having as good of a time. It's not as easy to have as good of a time as it is in September, October, when it's less hot, less crowded.
Dave, I want to ask you, what do you think is probably the most commonly overlooked thing when planning a Disney vacation?
The most overlooked thing when planning a Disney vacation is planning itself. If you were going to go to the beach, you would figure, okay, when is it warm? And that's about 90% of your decision-making. If you were going to go on a backpacking trip, you'd put an enormous amount of time in ahead of it. You've got to figure out your routes, your gear, your food, your resupply points. And Disney World is much more like a backpacking trip. It takes a fair degree of planning early on to minimize the kind of misery that Josh was just talking about. And so that's what's, I think, most misunderstood, is that if you plan even a little, you know, pick the right times, pick the right prices, pick the right ways to work your days, all of which we cover in the book, you can have a great trip. And if you don't plan, you can be miserable.
Dave, so you live out of Florida. How often do you get down here to visit Disney World?
I'm in Florida 6 to 8 times a year, usually for about a month if you add it all up. So nothing like the depth of Josh's experience, but I've been doing that for the last 7 years. So but between us, we know a lot and we've done a lot. We've made all the mistakes and we've learned how to tell other people not to make them.
What about with regards to your interactions with Disney? I mean, do you and maybe Dave, question for you too, do you guys talk to Disney about, you know, try and get advice from them on when you're putting this guide together, or is it completely independent of what Disney's doing?
I've literally never been contacted by Disney or contacted them in years. Mm-hmm. Never heard a word.
Dave, how about yourself?
It's almost the same. I was contacted by Disney once when I made an error on my site, and it was causing them trouble, and they asked me to fix it, and I was delighted to fix it. And then I reached out to those same people about 3 years later when Disney's website had its price seasons wrong.
It's interesting to me because I know that, you know, you guys aren't the only game in town when it comes to websites, guides to Disney. There's kind of a cottage industry almost of people who spend a lot of time at theme parks, really put the legwork in, so to speak, and have an insider's knowledge almost of the way Disney works. There's kind of this whole site industry beside the behemoth that is Disney itself. It strikes me as interesting that Disney just kind of, you know, is content to let things happen like that and not too worried about having, you know, much of a hand in what people put in their guidebooks.
My theory has always been, Matthew, that anything that helps people experience Disney World in a better way is good for Disney. And that's how they think about the cottage industry, is that in general and on average, it's helpful to people. And that doesn't mean everybody is. Josh and I both know lots of sites that aren't so great. But in general and on average, we help people have better experiences, and that helps Disney's business results in the long run. But by being completely independent of them, we can say things like, don't stay at this resort, stay at that resort instead. That would be very awkward for Disney to say about itself.
Have you noticed them making tweaks after you've put things on your websites or even in a previous guide or something like that? Without them contacting you, of course, just kind of noticing what you were saying about the park experience and modifying it after you've said something about it?
I think that there have been things that happened in time sequentially that I kind of had in the back of my head. I wonder if they read my site. But I think that there are so many things that they have to worry about that, while I know some Disney senior people and cast members read my site. As you said, back to the cottage industry, there's a lot of people speaking. Mm-hmm. And Disney must go crazy trying to keep up with it all if they try to. Josh, what do you think?
Well, of course I have a high opinion of my opinion, so I would say yes. When Anna and Elsa first came to Magic Kingdom, people were running down Main Street, and I took a video of the pandemonium. And then 3 or 4 days later, they completely changed how they did their opening procedure to the point where they were putting 15, 20, 25 cast members to walk the thousands of people there at opening. I'll rail against food from time to time, and none of those items are still on the menus. So is it just me who didn't like the Angus pizza burger? Probably not, but because I say I didn't like it and thousands of people read it and don't order it, their numbers must be impacted by that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you too, Josh, how did you get so fascinated with Disney? What kind of got you hooked on it in the first place? And I mean, it seems like it's almost a full-time job for you now.
I think it's a great place for families to enjoy time together, and it's unique in that people go and they keep going back to the same things and experiencing it in different ways. It's not unique to Disney, but it's unique to Orlando and everything that we offer here.
Mm-hmm. How about yourself, Dave? What's the kind of thing that keeps you coming back to Disney?
Yeah, there's two different things. One is it's fun. And it's fun for me in every different way. I mean, it's fun in the kind of obvious direct experience of the environments. But it's also fun, you know, as I put on my business hat, to think about how things interact strategically and operationally, and how decisions seem to have been made to create certain things and not create other things. where I put on my other hat, where I worked on a PhD in English literature, and I think of it from the point of view of a poem that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and how has the creator directed the experience through time, you know, using color and sound and physical objects to create an effect. So I find it fascinating from the dimensions of the kind of highest order of business strategy to the smallest points of operational strategy to the, you know, classic aesthetic questions of how do you create a set of feelings in a person and how do you pick and choose among the options available to you to create that experience.
I want to ask about technology. Disney often has some kind of new things they try out. I know the RFID wristbands they've been rolling out. Have you guys had much to kind of say about those advances in technology? Dave, I wonder if you could comment on those.
Yeah, a fundamental reason that why we wrote this book is that not only is there no other guidebook that's aimed right at first-timers, but also there's no other guidebook that's been written from the start with this new technology in mind. And, you know, the wristbands are just a part of it, Matthew. The biggest point, although Josh might disagree with me on this, is the whole new FastPass Plus system, which is all technology-enabled and fundamentally changes how you approach the parks and what you need to do 60 days beforehand and how you think about planning your days. And so our book covers that soup to nuts.
Josh, what's your experience been of these new wristbands?
It's a complicated new initiative that they've been trying to get right now for going on 18 months, and it works now better than it ever has. Whether it will ultimately be successful and they'll get that $2.5 billion back remains to be seen, I think.
Do you think other parks are looking to see how they work before rolling out something similar?
Well, one of the ultimate goals of My Magic Plus and this initiative is trapping as much of the tourists' money on property as possible, and I think any business is interested in capturing the highest market that they can. And if this ends up working, then Universal will be following suit as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Josh, do you spend any time checking out the other theme parks, or are you pretty much all Disney all the time?
We do have annual passes to Universal. I was just there last night. We're going to SeaWorld tomorrow, so yes, certainly.
How do you think they stack up? I know they're not as big and expansive as Disney, but do you think people can get the same kind of all-encompassing experience at Universal or even SeaWorld as they would at Disney?
Absolutely. Both companies and both theme parks have a lot to offer. I think Universal with Diagon Alley has a whole lot to offer, but they don't offer the Disney bubble, the all-encompassing week-long vacation where Disney picks you up from the airport. You never have to leave property. They bus you around. They have the size advantage. Whereas even now, you think about a Universal vacation, maybe 2 or 3 days, you tack on a day at SeaWorld, maybe you tack on a day at Busch Gardens, maybe you go out to Legoland, but they don't have the bubble, and they never will.
Mm-hmm. Dave, I'm wondering, I know that in your book you say you have some kind of suggested itineraries, and you talk about maybe a 9-day trip with some, you know, pretty much all that spent at Disney, but do you advise people to sort of do some other things in Central Florida when they're coming down here or just basically hit the park? Because I know you could spend all your time at Disney, and as Josh says, you're kind of in a bubble that whole time. You'll probably never run out of things to do while you're in that bubble.
Yeah, there's kind of, at the simplest level, there's two kinds of visitors. There's one kind who, when it is planning to come, does not know if it's ever going to return. And for that group, assuming that they're not made of money and they don't have 3 weeks that they can take off, I would say, yes, do focus on Disney. If you're never going to be able to return and you can do only one thing in Orlando and you can do only one thing well, then do Disney World well. But absolutely, as Josh says, if you have more time or if you know you can return, of course you should go to SeaWorld. It's great. Of course you should go to Universal. It's great. Of course you should go to Busch Gardens and Legoland and even get out of the parks and see some of the real Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just another question too, as a follow-up. I mean, Josh talks about the bubble with Disney and how he doesn't think the other theme parks are probably ever going to be able to compete on the same level. But do you see Disney's kind of preeminence as unending here, Dave? Or do you think the other parks will be able to eat some of their Disney's kind of market share in terms of the numbers of visitors going through the gates? I know we've got Legoland too, as came up just now as well.
I think there's two parts to that. One is that, as Josh was talking about earlier, that Disney has become such a family experience, and it goes back, at least in Orlando, to 71. So you now have great-grandchildren at Disney World whose great-grandparents were at the Magic Kingdom in 1971. That's really hard to stop. You know, that flow of repeat visits that are almost framed as much around nostalgia for younger selves and younger faces is not ever going to go away. But, you know, over any short to medium term horizon, it's a question of who is delivering the better experience, who's putting out the better rides, who's refreshing the restaurants, who's refurbishing their hotel rooms. And Orlando, you know, Universal Orlando is doing everything right. And they are willing to invest even more. It's like they finally have an owner who deserves them. And the owner is really putting a lot of capital in there and is willing to follow that with more capital so long as the returns keep rolling in the way they have been. So I think Universal Orlando has every opportunity to continue to pull more money from the total tourist market in Orlando like it has over the last couple of years. But competing against the you know, Disney, of course, is fiercely competitive itself, and Disney will react. Disney has been reacting, and it'll just be interesting to see how that unfolds over the next decade.
Yeah, sometimes it's almost like you're looking at a bit of an arms race in terms of the attractions. They roll out one after the other.
Exactly.
Is this guide, do you think, the first of many editions, or are you kind of one and done for this?
We're certainly hoping so. You know, we think it's the best goodbye guidebook out there for first-timers. We think that first-timers need the help. We've tried to help them on our sites, and we think that the part of the world that wants guidebooks needs this guidebook, and if they buy it the way that they ought to make their lives happier, then edition after edition will come over the years.
Josh, are you on board with that?
Hopefully there will be more in the future.
Is it available as an ebook as well?
It is on Kindle and paperback. We're going to update the Kindle version throughout the year as things change, so you're not only limited by what's in the paperback version, but you'll also get updates on the Kindle as things change, and I don't think that's something any of the other guidebooks are doing.
Well, I've been speaking to Josh Humphrey and Dave Shute. Dave and Josh are the authors of The Easy Guide to Your First Walt Disney World Visit. It's a new guidebook, which is pretty self-explanatory in the title, and they also publish yourfirstvisit.net and easywdw.com. Josh, thanks for coming into the studio.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Dave Shute, thanks for joining us by phone.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, I revisit a conversation with National Geographic Editor-at-Large Chris Elliott. I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Elliott. Christopher is the editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveller. His latest book is How to Be the World's Smartest Traveller and Save Time, Money and Hassle. Christopher, thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, first of all, according to a Travellers United study, 8 out of 10 Americans said they were planning to travel this summer, suggesting that this could be maybe the greatest resurgence for travel since the Great Recession. What do you think accounts for this upcoming busy summer?
Well, you know, I think that it's been, we've had, what, 4 or 5 years of basically no one taking a vacation. So this is the first summer that people are actually thinking about going somewhere. And I think that, you know, it's kind of a long overdue thing. So that's what the research is showing, is that people are finally planning to go somewhere.
How do cities like Orlando with its theme parks factor into this? Do you think people are more likely to travel within the United States than splash out on a big overseas trip?
Well, you know, Orlando is one of the top 3 or 4 destinations for inbound international travel. So, you know, you're talking about two different things here. You're talking about trips that Americans are taking to other places and trips that people from outside the states are taking to here. I think that when it comes to Americans, we just have put off having a vacation for so long that we really, at this point, don't care where we go. whether it's a weekend staycation somewhere during the summer, or if we're going to Europe. I think that it's very difficult to generalize and say, you know, we're all taking a vacation to Orlando, or we're all going to New York or something like that. But in terms of inbound destination traffic, Orlando, it seems to be somewhere between number three and number four. It's competing with destinations like Las Vegas and New York and Los Angeles and Miami, too.
And yet it's still getting something in the line of 57 million visitors a year. That's quite a big number, even if it's number three or four.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we do a lot of things right here in Orlando. I've been here for the last 10 years. I've called Orlando home, and I get to see firsthand. We take our kids to the park. And when I say park, I don't mean that we're taking them to the park across the street. We take them to the parks like Universal and Disney and SeaWorld. And we see firsthand how Orlando is kind of like the gold standard in customer service and in taking care of its tourists. So it's nice to see that, because I write about tourism all the time. I cover it. I cover customer service in particular. So it's good to see how it's done here, and it's really kind of a we're really role models here, I think, for the rest of the U.S. tourism industry.
Now, your book is packed with lots of interesting information. You talk a lot about how people are now relying a lot on online booking, bypassing the travel agent, just doing things themselves. I mean, that's been something which has been happening for a while. But I'm wondering, how is planning, do you think, for travel changed now that there is so much of this user-driven content available out on the internet?
Well, you're talking about TripAdvisor and Yelp,
sure,
and
yeah,
user-generated reviews. I think it's changed things a lot, and not necessarily for the better, because these sites are, in many cases, they're anonymous, so you don't know who's writing the reviews, and you don't know even what those people's priorities are, what their lifestyle is like, so you don't know if their recommendation is going to work for you. The thing that's problematic and that I learned in researching this book is that many people are just looking at one or two reviews and making a booking decision based on it. So they're going to TripAdvisor and they're looking, how many stars does this hotel have or destination have, and or restaurant, I should say. And then they're making a decision based strictly on that one review. And one of the things I say in this book is that you really have to cast a very wide net, because that's the only way that you're going to get really good, reliable advice. So go to the user-generated review sites. I'm not saying don't use them, but ask a friend. Go to a guidebook. Go to a media site, you know, a Frommer's or a Fodor's, and get advice from all kinds of places. Talk to a trusted travel agent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way that you're going to not make that mistake of making a reservation based strictly on an unvetted review and ending up in a place where you're disappointed, maybe.
What about the role of actual real-life travel agents? Is there still a place for a live travel agent?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, travel agents were left for dead a couple of years ago, which is too bad, because there are some really great travel agents out there. And I think that if you have – there are certain types of trips that you really don't want to try to book alone. If you're doing an around-the-world itinerary – that can get very complex very quickly. So my advice would be, use a good travel agent. And there are a couple of other times, too. A destination wedding, for instance, you definitely want to use someone who knows what they're doing. But then there are also some where you don't want to bother a travel agent. For instance, a simple point-to-point trip, an Amtrak trip somewhere. You know, you don't want to bother an agent. You just go onto the website and book the trip.
Mm-hmm. You have a chapter on safety. I'm just wondering, is there anywhere in the world that's truly safe for a traveler?
Yeah, your own living room, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things I say in this book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler, is that if you want to have an absolutely sure thing, if you want to be absolutely safe, then you stay home. Of course, I'll eat my words, because you could always have a sinkhole and then it's game over. But
sure, hurricane blow through.
And so I think, you know, there are safer destinations that you can go to, and then there are some that you definitely do want to avoid. One of the things I say in the book is you have to do your research. You've got to go to the State Department website and check it out. If you're flying to that place, don't assume that you're going to get a refund if the State Department tells all the Americans to get out, because that rather rarely happens. The airline would have to cancel the flight in order for you to get a refund. Mm-hmm. So do a little bit of research beforehand, and if you have misgivings, choose somewhere safer. You know, do a staycation, stay here at home.
We have a pretty big airport here in Orlando. Is that a good thing if you're looking to fly out of Central Florida? Is that kind of put more options at your disposal?
Oh, yeah. Well, I love the Orlando airport. It is actually one of the reasons that I'm here, is it's just a great airport to fly in and out of. It's not too expensive. You know, you've got some really good airlines running out of here. So yeah, it's good. And people come from all over Florida to fly out of Orlando. I just don't see a downside to it at all. Mm-hmm. I know that there's some expansion going on. It's all positive.
What about scanners? You write about scanners in this book. You're not a fan of the scanning technology.
No, some of that actually has already been unplugged, which is good, very positive for travelers. The problem with the TSA is that they have had this rule, and it was a knee-jerk reaction to the underwear bomber of a couple of years ago. And now if you're not part of the pre-check program, which is their trusted traveler program, you have to go through one of these body scanners, and if you don't, they'll give you an enhanced pat-down. I have to ask you, have you ever been patted down at the TSA checkpoint?
I don't recall, actually. Because it's a memory, I've probably blocked it out.
Yeah, right. You probably would remember. It's a fairly intense process where they're using more force in the pat-down than they maybe did in the past. They call it an enhanced pat-down. So they're really touching every part of your body. A lot of people think that this is a violation of their civil rights. I happen to agree that enhanced pat-downs really, unless you're in prison, they shouldn't be doing them. So we're moving right now to much more of a risk-based screening system where the people who are considered to be more of a risk are going to be going through those scanners, and everyone else gets to be scanned like they used to be, which is going through the magnetometers, not having to take your shoes off, putting your bag on the conveyor belt and setting it through, that sort of thing. I just think the TSA probably they've been too reactive and not proactive enough. And that really is, it's slow to change. It's a very bureaucratic organization, and they don't like to explain themselves. So when you ask them why they're doing something, they're not likely to tell you. They're just going to say it's for security, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on other tips people might want to keep in mind to be a safe and savvy traveler?
The book that I wrote is kind of an amalgamation of all the bad things that have happened to people over 20 years of helping solve travel problems. And I wish that I could hand this out at the airport. And if there was one thing that I could say, it would be just plan ahead a little bit. Call your airline to make sure your flight's leaving on time. Call to confirm your hotel reservation. 90% of the problems happen when people just assume things and they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So if you did just a little bit of advanced planning and verified that your flight is leaving on time or your hotel still has a reservation for you, you could probably avoid most of the problems.
I've been speaking to Christopher Elliott. He's the editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. His latest book is How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. Christopher, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's been my pleasure.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.